night of August 4th, which is, this is an important night. It was so dark. Clouds covered all the stars and the moon. If you put your hand in front of your face, you could not even see your hand. It was that dark. Well, that night, we got a report that they were attacking us, getting ready to attack us. Now, keep in mind, as you cannot even see your hand. We started firing, and then we started getting reports of torpedoes in the water. We were doing high-speed turns to avoid these torpedoes. Turner Joy was also getting the same thing. And we started firing our guns at what they thought were boats out there. And then it was with both Turner Joy and us firing numerous rounds. Aircraft from the carrier came in and they were dropping these rounds that lit up the entire area. And they could not see anything either. But we kept firing and firing, dodging torpedoes. I think there was approximately 23 torpedoes that were supposedly fired at us. After a while, we broke off, and then there was trying to figure out what happened. For some reason, our radar was not working right. There were no boats out there. That's been proven. We were firing at nothing. There never were any torpedoes fired at us. And our sonar men were giving us false information. What happens is when a ship goes into a high-speed turn, the propellers form what they call a knuckle. It's a huge air bubble. They were pinging off of these knuckles, calling them in as torpedoes in the water coming at us. Well, the commanding officer knew that there was probably an error, that there really was no attack. And he passed this on up the chain to the White House. It's my understanding that President Johnson was given this information that we should hold off, that it appears that there was not an attack. President Johnson ignored that information. On August 5th, he went before Congress and asked for permission to escalate the war. I bring more troops in.
It was a phantom.
Right. On August 4th, it was bogus. It never happened.
When you first get there, what are some of your responsibilities and how do those change over time? Typical missions, and so if there was a typical mission.
So when I first got there, I'm a new guy in the unit. I got put on guard duty. So it was an artillery base. There were 90 Marines, and we had 6 105 howitzers, and the base had 4 outposts, one in each corner. So I was put on one of those outposts to stand guard, and that was March 24th. On April 18th, less than a month later, we were attacked and overrun, and 3 of the 4 outposts fell. Mine was the only outpost that didn't fall. We had 5 men killed and 28 men wounded out of 90 of us. The enemy left 40 bodies behind, and they destroyed the howitzers, the ammo dump, and the fuel dump. The next morning when the infantry got there to relieve us, the first thing that we did was take the wounded and dead Americans to get help to the front. The dead Americans were laid next to a bunker with ponchos over them. The wounded Americans were medevaced. I went around and I put a bullet in the head of each of the Vietnamese bodies to make sure they were dead and took stuff out of their pockets to turn into the front. We followed blood trails and I murdered a man who was just a farmer. And I was really angry about what happened the night before. I asked this guy where the VC went. Guy couldn't talk English. I couldn't talk Vietnamese. And the guy wasn't responsive, and I killed him. I wanted to get them back for what they did to us. I was really angry. And I thought, like, we had come to Vietnam to help the Vietnamese. They wanted democracy. And the Vietnamese from the north were communists, and they came to the south, and they wouldn't let the Vietnamese have their freedom. But the people that attacked my camp and overran us were Viet Cong, and the Viet Cong were South Vietnamese. So I was upset about that. I was really off about that. After we got all of the things cleaned up, then I went to the front and I pulled the ponchos off of each of the dead Marines to see who they were. And one of them was my first friend.
Maine.
And so I looked at him and I thought, I'm in a place where it's people's job to kill me. That's their job, and they're allowed to do it. There's no timeout. There's no King's X. There's no do-overs. I need to pay attention or I'm going to die.
What kind of planes were these, and then what type of bombs were they using?
Okay, these were a variety, mostly F-105 fighter bombers and F-4 fighter bombers. They would carry 1,000-pound or mostly 500-pound bombs to go drop bombs on North Vietnam. There was another mission that we had to flight follow B-52s. We would track them, try to make a line exactly where they're going to go, and then they would drop their bombs from higher altitude on suspected Vietnam structures or bridges or whatever. The other thing that we did, we had reconnaissance flight, RF-4Cs, that would fly around and take pictures to see what kind of the situation was, basically.
About how far would these runs occur, like when they would go out from, you know, the takeoff point to the bombing and then circle back? What was that kind of distance?
I had never thought about it, frankly, so, you know, but about certainly more than 100 miles.
Yeah.
There was one episode where I saw one blip of an emergency squawk, emergency transponder return, and followed up. I didn't see it anymore, so I marked a spot on my radar map, followed up, and it turns out that that RF-4C edging flight had been shot down. So they scrambled from Nakhon Phnom on the corner of northeast corner of Thailand where I was. They had the Jolly Green Giants rescue helicopters and A-1E Sandies, and they went out and actually rescued the two pilots. So I felt really good about that particular episode of helping my job, saving some people. So
that's outstanding. Did you lose anyone, I guess, on any of these missions that you recall?
No. Well, I shouldn't say that. There were time and time again people would be shot down. I was not ever because what we would do is after they would leave our, you know, after they would get refueled, then they would go to a combat control frequency and talk to them about where they, you know, actually the dropping the bombs and everything. And so they would come back to us. We certainly had times when they would come back to us desperate for getting fuel, and so we would direct them, and they say, well, I'm going to have to eject if I don't get fuel immediately. And so there were certainly stressful situations like that, but none of the airplanes, whenever I was controlling them, was on my frequency whenever they had actual shot down.
So that was my next question, is what years were you there then, and then where exactly within country were you?
Yeah, I was there from 66 to 67. The assignment for almost everybody was 1 year of duty in Vietnam, which was probably a mistake in retrospect, to fight a war with constant turnover and inexperienced men and women coming in. Was not a good way to fight a conflict, particularly when you had an enemy that was as strong and well-organized as the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong. That was my length of service, roughly September to mid September 1966 to August 1967. I got out a little bit early, about 15 days, because there are lots of troops they were bringing in at that time. But I was a second lieutenant, was promoted to first lieutenant while I was there, and captain before I stepped out of the military. When you retire, you'll lose a rank, so I fell back to first lieutenant. I was all over the Third Corps area that covered from Tainan in the eastern part of Vietnam to the coast around Cam Ranh Bay and then down to Saigon and just below Saigon. So I was in much of that area. My unit was initially, the 40th Signal Battalion was initially assigned to Long Binh, which became one of the major areas of American military officers that commanded the tactical activities throughout that area of Vietnam. When we got there, we were the second unit into Long Binh, but ultimately there were over 60,000 men, I think, by 1969 in Long Binh. So it became, it built up fast, which created some chaos in itself. But and so when we got there, we didn't do anything in the way of Signal Corps activity. We basically filled sandbags, erected tents and built sandbags around the tents and around the compound and fencing around the compound. And then made sure that the military police got around and informed everybody where the other American units were, because there was, everybody was anxious. Everybody had been watching Vietnam on television and assumed when you got there you'd be right in the midst of the conflict with no rest, which was not the case. But that was what new troops felt, new units that were coming in. And so they were trigger happy, and you had to make sure they knew where you were or they might end up shooting at you, which happened on occasion.
Do you recall your first encounter with enemy and what it was like?
Well, it wasn't my first encounter with the enemy per se, but it was my first combat assault. Combat assault is helicopters going into a landing zone. The landing zone was hot. The NVA were there. And I had not had a whole lot of experience with helicopters, particularly in a combat situation where they fly in very fast, flare, and then drop down. And when they flared, my radio telephone operator, who's sitting next to me in the aircraft, nudged me. And I thought he told me it was time to get out. So I stepped out at about 10 to 15 feet above the ground. And fortunately, it was a very soft landing. But I do remember the my medic and my RTO each grabbed me by an arm and get me up out of the mud saying, "Let's go, Lieutenant." So, and that one. First engagement was more, you know, keep your head down, figure out what's going on, and then maneuver as you need to.
And I assume from there you were involved in heavier fighting at times?
Yeah. Yeah, we had some really tremendous engagements. And it's hard to explain every one of them, because some of them are fleeting engagements, some of them are more static. We have a tendency in the military, in the U.S. military anyway, to use our indirect fire weapons very effectively. I mean, we don't just, you know, line up and charge. That's not a good way to do things. And so we use our indirect fire weapons very effectively.
Did you have any, during either of those two tours, encounters with journalists or the news media in the field at all?
No. Trying to remember, I think there was a couple of journalists that came out during my second tour, and I'm trying to remember, it was Dan Rather or one of the other ones, I can't remember, one of the more famous ones, and the field first sergeant came to me and he said, "Captain, we've got a problem." I said, "Well, what's wrong, Todd?" He said, "They're looking for a bad egg." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, they're talking to everybody, but they're not filming, they're not recording. Oh. Well, the guy that ended up on television was a guy that had just gotten out of jail for being AWOL and losing his weapon. And he's the one who represented us on national television. And I thought to myself, you know, that's the most dishonest thing I've seen in a long, long time. So as a consequence, my view of combat or journalist in that regard, pretty low.
Yeah. Do you recall what they said on air that was so disaltering?
Well, you know, this is a tough time in Vietnam, and the soldiers' morale is not high, and this guy went on and on about how bad things were and how they were smoking dope all the time. And I go, okay.
That would have been
about
68, 67?
This was 69.
As you begin to get settled in through the 70s, I mean, did your ostracization locally, did that extend all the way through the war and after, or was there a certain point at which, with the longer hair and everything else, you didn't feel quite so cut out?
What I did was, every person has to deal with it on the best way. The way that I deal with it was just held everything inside. I held inside what I saw, what I went through, what I did. I'm still holding in most of that. I'm not ready to talk about it. I was asked to give a speech to a group here in town about my experience in Vietnam. So it took me about 2 weeks to write it out. And because I want to be careful what I said, because I didn't want to break down in tears as I'm trying to give a speech. But I asked my wife if she wanted to go. She broke down. She did not have any idea that I had been through what I had been through. And I told her, honey, that's only what I feel like talking about now.
During the period in which you were having nightmares and so forth, was that what you referenced with you couldn't trust anybody, or were there specific battles or encounters with the enemy that caused that? What?
There were encounters that there. Some of this I'm not ready to talk about.
That's okay. Fine. If you want to walk back. Okay.
There were... the battles did not occur like what you see at the Battle of Hue, where it's over a long period of time. The battles occur over a two-hour period of time. It all of a sudden happens, and it's all of a sudden over. You have to depend on your training, your adrenaline rush, and your belief in God to help get you through it. And whenever it's over, I mean, you're drained. And from time to time, you do have memories of things that, yeah, I remember that happening. I remember now how I got that scar on my elbow, my forearm. And I remember, you know, a little bit of that, but I just tried to put it all out of my mind, okay? And it was a long time ago. All right, now I had a scar up here.
Are these shrapnel wounds you're demonstrating, pretty much?
There's a scar up here somewhere, okay? I didn't think anything of it, because I mean, whenever I got it, yes, I was over in combat area, and yeah, it bled for a little bit, but, you know, just to put enough pressure on it, and it stops. I didn't think anything else about it. So, years later, get ready to get married, my wife says, you know, you got a bump on your back. So, back on the shoulder blade, I had a bump that's about that big around, that stuck out about that far. And whenever you wear a golf shirt, it's, you know, show up. She says, I think you need to go have, you know, that lanced or taken out or whatever it is. That was a piece of metal. So, you know, from
Southeast Asia, somewhere.
Southeast Asia. Yeah, who would have thought, you know? How come I didn't know that? Because of the adrenaline and everything you got going, it just doesn't register.
Rotation back to the States for Vietnam. For soldiers in Vietnam, is is very unceremonious. And I'll tell you how unceremonious. You've been flying, you've been, you know, or you were in the field like my friends who were 0311s. I medevaced one of my friends. That's an interesting story, but we don't have time. But he was at Khe Sanh, which was under siege for 72 days or more than that. But massive artillery and a lot of Marines lost their lives there. And we got the call to go up to Khe Sanh, and we had to medevac someone, and it turned out to be one of my kids that I went to high school with. So that was an interesting thing. But anyway, it was very unceremonious because after what you've been through, regardless of what your experience was, you've been through some traumatic events. Your whole life, your whole way of looking at life has changed. And suddenly someone walks in and just hands you a sheet of paper and says, you got 30 minutes to get on that C-130, you're going home. It's like, huh? You're kind of befuddled, baffled. I'm leaving? And you think, in a moment, a million different things begin to course through your brain. I'm leaving Jim. I'm leaving Dennis. I'm leaving Pat. You know, whomever that you're tight with. You've flown with them or even just worked side by side with them, have observed people die. A lot of men did heroic things, and you're thinking, I can't leave these guys. I don't want to leave these guys. I don't want to go home. You know what's waiting for you at home. For me, my girlfriend had broken up with me. My parents were so proud of me as a Marine, but I knew that once I was home for a short period of time, it would be life as usual. And where do I go from here? I mean, it all courses through your brain. In an instant, you're thinking to yourself, how will I be prepared for this? Will I be prepared for this? But also, the other half of you says, I'm out of here. I didn't get killed. And I'm going home.
You mentioned that you were not a specific combat photographer, but that you would end up in these situations as that firefight or whatever it was started to develop, or an ambush. Did you continue shooting, or did you kind of just try to look for that exit route?
I was with the lieutenant. We were in a Jeep during Tet. We were sent somewhere out on the outskirts of Saigon. I was driving him. And the citation said we were ambushed. We really weren't ambushed. We just drove into the middle of a firefight. We came around the street and on the outskirts of Saigon, and the road was blocked, and there was a bunch of people, Allied troops, American troops, South Vietnamese troops, and it was by the air base, so there was some Air Force personnel shooting over us. And then behind us was whoever was shooting at them. And we just pulled right up in the middle. That was the most amazing thing. And then the firing stopped. It was like, what the hell are you two idiots doing out there in the middle of the firefight, you know? And so MP laying in a ditch saying, get over here, get out of your damn Jeep and get over here before you get blown away. And this is all within a matter of seconds. And as soon as we got out of the Jeep to run over the ditch, then everybody's okay, well, they're dumb enough to be out there, let's start shooting again. So everybody started shooting, and the lieutenant, unfortunately, he got hit in the butt, and we scrambled in the ditch, and then, you know, within a half hour, everything was over with, and we got back in the Jeep and took him to the hospital, and everything was fine.
So what are you doing during all of that, besides ducking for your life?
I wasn't photographing, because I didn't know where the fire was coming from. What was interesting about that particular episode is, I could hear stuff going over me. It's like a zip-type noise. But since we were in the middle, I didn't know if it was them shooting over our heads or the enemy shooting over our heads at them. So I was kind of like confused and I didn't know where to fire because there was a city. You know, I didn't know if that there were civilians there or what. And it wasn't like there was an enemy soldier standing there firing at me. He was concealed. So I didn't return fire, and I didn't take photographs because I left the camera in the car. I mean, in the Jeep, because I was hauling into the ditch.
Was there any one particular moment or set of moments that surprised or shocked you?
The cruelty that Americans displayed to the South Vietnamese. And since I was new to the country, I didn't really understand why Americans were so abusive to the South Vietnamese Army and literally knocking them off their vehicles with our vehicles or, always saying bad things about them because those guys even held hands and it wasn't just a sign of homosexuality. It was just that was their culture. Guys hold hands over there. You know, that was a culture shock to me to see two soldiers holding hands, you know. And then, after I was there for a while, I realized what incompetent soldiers they were and how they didn't seem to be giving a about what was going on in their country. And they were letting the Americans take over all the actions and all the things. And they were always behind the lines, reluctant to advance, reluctant to do anything. And then it wasn't until I got home and got older and a little bit more experienced and understand that, well, they've been fighting that war from the get-go, and I was just doing mine 1 year and getting in, or a year and a half in my case, and getting out, and they stayed there. So their whole lives was war.
At the time I was drafted, I didn't worry about it because there was a height limit of 6'6", and I played basketball in college. And I was drafted out of Brooklyn, they measured me, and I had a huge afro. And they measured me about 9 or 10 times. And I got under 6'6" by 1/16 of an inch.
1/16 of an inch is the difference between you serving and you not serving at that point.
Correct.
How did you feel about that?
Very, very, very bad about it. Extremely bitter and angry. And the reason why is because I didn't have any clothes to fit me while in the service in basic training in South Carolina. I only had basic fatigue pants and shirts because I didn't have any dress uniforms because I had skinny neck, very long arms.
You mentioned your mother earlier. How did your parents feel about you joining the military or you being drafted into the military?
They were very bitter because I received a draft notice on my mother's birthday, January the 11th of 1968.
Had your family served at any particular point, or had they served at World War II level even?
My father served in World War II, what he called the Colored Army. He was a motor pool sergeant, and he fixed trucks, and he was wounded in action, and he received a Purple Heart, but he became an alcoholic based on pain medication.
Dealing with post-war, either, dealing with it or dealing with something that happened in war obviously affected your father.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did.
Did that give you any pause about when you went off to war, about how you saw your father go through and come back and how you might be affected?
Yes, it did. I was affected. Many of my family sort of disowned me and labeled me, crazy for my experiences, looking at the Huntley-Brinkley report and what my unit did in the war, it frightened them and terrified them. So I basically went underground and didn't talk about nothing to no one.
Did you know anybody in your family or friends that chose to purposely not serve or to avoid the draft?
Yes.
Did you ever consider not serving?
Yes. Yes. I actually... after I had finished AIT training and at Fort Polk, which is advanced infantry training, I went home for leave. I decided to not show up at Seattle, Washington, to go to Vietnam. But I got caught. I was pretty stupid. The only idea I had was military. So in Canada, above Niagara Falls, I had to show my ID, and they just put me on a bus and then went on a plane, and I went to Vietnam.
First contact with the enemy, do you recall?
We'd go out and patrol. Usually we'd go out for 3 days, come back in, sleep a while, go back out again. That was common. I think the longest period of time I was ever out at one time was 26 days. And we were chasing some people.
Did you find them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had night logged. There was a Catholic church out in the middle of nowhere in the jungle. And there was like a Filipino nun. There was an American nun. A couple of Vietnamese nuns. They let us eat with them. And they fed us that night. And we just made a night logger around this church. We left and came back 2 days later. And the Viet Cong had come in. And because they helped us or fed us, cut their noses off, raped them, killed them. They know that Americans were very vain and what have you, so they knew that that would really agitate us. So anyway, we started tracking them. There was eight of us. We think they were probably 35 or 50 of them. They realized after we'd gone so far that they thought that they could take us. So they started chasing us. So it was a day and night thing going, running from them. And we're calling for our people. And the line company set up a wedge. And we ran them through the wedge. And they caught them in a crossfire and got all of them. We usually traveled eight with a dog.
Like a canine dog?
A police dog. His name was King. If you take a prisoner, it was a lot easier to tell King to keep an eye on him, take him up, put their hands behind him, lean him up against a tree, and tell that dog to watch him. If they moved, they blinked eye or anything, that dog was right there. They were scared to death of a police dog.
And was one of you a handler for King?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Like yeah. Trained?
Oh yeah, yeah, they're highly trained. You could talk to that dog like a human being. He knew what a rifle was, weaponry. You know, he knew what he just knew. Often we'd be back in the LZ and we're all the time playing tricks on each other and stuff. We'd catch the handler maybe asleep and the dog there. And we'd tell King, say, bring us his weapon. That dog would go grab the sling and drag the weapon over to us. And then we'd all jump up and yell, incoming! And again, be looking for his weapon, looking for anything, you know. And it's pretty wild. You had to keep some kind of sense of humor, some kind of decency about things, you know.